This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
It's Kevin again, and it's great pleasure to now introduce our keynote presenter, which is Paul Adrian. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Kevin. How are you?
Good, good. All right, I'll just give a little bit of background for Paul. He's currently a training manager at Seeing Eye Dogs Division of Vision Australia. He began as a dog guide and O&M instructor in 1984. In a career spanning over 30 years, he's worked or completed assignments in Israel, USA, Hungary, Croatia, Bosnia, Norway, Slovakia, and Germany. Very well traveled. He has a strong interest in animal behaviour and welfare, and it's presented at many conferences, both national and international. And he's been an assessor for the International Guide Dog Federation. So very impressive background, Paul. Really looking forward to your presentation today. Over to you.
Thanks, Kevin. Sort of takes 35 plus years to build up the CV to the point where it is now, and it's been a real pleasure all of those years and all of those experiences. The last few days have been pretty hectic for me. I've been like a cat on hot bricks, and it's been difficult to prepare for this seminar. I've been trying to sell a unit I own down in McLeod in Victoria, and the lockdowns have been getting in the way of it. Auction day was supposed to be last Saturday, and that was obviously postponed due to the lockdown, and auction day became today. So I'm, you know, my blood pressure is well and truly through the roof, but the deal is done, and I can relax. So I'm pretty happy. But look, again, before I begin, listening to Brooke, listening to Anna and Mary and another presenter that I think is coming on later in Melinda, the industry's in great shape. These are, you know, I'm just really so impressed with the young people in our industry. They're smart, they're dedicated, you know, they're real believers in what we do. And I think we're really in great hands. And as I sort of drift towards the back end of my career, it's fabulous to see that we have this quality of people, and there's more besides who are going to be producing dog guides and providing service to consumers in the future. I think it's great to see. And again, before I begin, there's a couple of things I wanted to pick up from the previous presentation and just make a comment, because that's just what I do. Those of you who know me well know that I can't resist. Anna was talking particularly about the use of positive reinforcement. Now, I have to tell you, not only is the community more concerned about animal welfare and appropriate science-based training, but so is the International Guide Dog Federation. And schools that wish to retain membership of the Federation are going to have to demonstrate that they are using the best possible practices. Standards are continually reviewed, and they are being strengthened at all times. One of the principles underlying that is the concept of training methods that are the least intrusive and minimally aversive. And that's a mantra that I think you're going to hear more of in the future. The other thing about welfare is to consider that often when we think about welfare, we often think about it as avoiding suffering or preventing suffering, but actually welfare is much more than that. And welfare is also about adding pleasure. And your dogs and other animals are capable of experiencing pleasure. And we understand so much more about that these days. Anna was mentioning the training dogs to hop into the MRI. And one of the outcomes of those experiments was showing that trained well, the pleasure centers in the dog's brain were lighting up. And this isn't restricted simply to dogs alone, but can be seen in other animals. So, speaking to a group of dog lovers here, I think we all intuitively know that our dogs can experience pleasure. There was another comment that I just wanted to pick up on, and that was the talk a little bit about recall that Mary was mentioning. And I recall in Norway watching a just-trained team complete what a test that they have to do. It's a government-defined test with a government observer there. And one of the aspects of the test before they graduate and the school is paid for the dog is that they have to do a free run. And this school has been an adopter of positive reinforcement, and most of their clients carry a little pouch with some treats in that pouch. But in that pouch is also some chopped up sausage. And for recall, they always use the sausage just to make sure those dogs come back during that test. So that's an example of not only using positive reinforcement, but choosing the positive reinforcement that's most likely to motivate the dog to do what we want. And again, picking up something from Mary about the public acceptance of German Shepherd dogs, it is a real concern for some people, and the bad press over many years has impacted the way the public respond. But it's not so in all cultures, and in many ways the German Shepherd is the Labrador dog of Germany. And I can remember being on a bus in Germany with a client with a German Shepherd, and some school children are getting onto that bus, and them wanting to run up and hug the German Shepherd in the same way that many of you might have experienced with young people wanting to interact with your Labbies or Golden Retrievers here. So it's very much a cultural thing. Those German Shepherds are viewed very differently in different cultures. Having said that, the majority of working dogs in Germany are becoming Labradors, although there's still a hardcore of people who really want German Shepherds. So let's now, after having said all of that, let me cycle back to the beginning and thank the Dog Guide Handlers Association for the invitation to speak today. And it's 30 minutes of freestyle, which is something that I really enjoy and appreciate. But I'd also like to acknowledge the work of the current board, the committee, and other interested parties, both present and past, of the DGHA, for the work they've done, not only in putting together a seminar program like today and tomorrow, but the work they've done to keep this organisation afloat and build its membership over time. I participate in a couple of committees, a number at the International Guide Dog Federation, and something that I can note, and many of you with experience on committees will know the truth of what I'm going to say, is that committee work is usually something we do beyond our day jobs, in our own time and under our own effort. And people often expect us to be able to do more with less. And so I really have to commend the members of the committee for the work they do and will continue to do. And whatever the membership can do to increase the membership and support for the DGHA, I think is well worthwhile, because I'm sure there is a role for consumer-based groups within the environment, and perhaps even more going forward. So congratulations to them, and thanks again for the invitation today. Also, with the floods, fires, and COVID, I hope that everybody is well and safe. and hopefully we have better times ahead. Today, you know, I'm going to be talking all over the place, and you know, about 20 minutes from now, I'm going to fall silent and respond to any questions. And I'm happy to take questions on anything that you might like. But I'm going to take you through a few things that have just sprung to mind for me. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my background, what brought me to the industry. And I began at Guide Dogs Victoria in 1984, but it wasn't my first attempt to join the industry. My first attempt to join the industry was ironically with an application I made to Seeing Eye Dogs when Phyllis Gratian was in charge, and their offices were in Thanet Street, Malvern. Some of you may remember that. And I decided to become a dog guide mobility instructor after I'd visited Canberra. And I was in Canberra for the express purpose of house minding for some friends who had a Labrador called Grant, and he needed at-home care while the family went on holidays. So there I was in Canberra with Grant, and one day I did a trip up to the top of Black Mountain, and at that time, I don't know if it still exists, there was a rope that led off into the bush, and I followed that rope and I got to a tree, and there was a brass plaque on that tree and it had dots on it, and I followed the rope a little bit further and there was another tree with a brass plaque on it with dots on it, and so on and so forth, and till I completed the walk, and I realised that what this walk was a walk for people who were braille dependent. And the dots described the trees that I was looking at. So I put two and two together at that point and thought, wow, blind people, Labradors, Grant, that could be an interesting career. I was in my early to mid 20s and I was really looking for something. So, you know, the first opportunity that came up was to interview with Seeing Eye Dogs, and I applied when they advertised, but I didn't successfully get an interview. A short time later, Guide Dogs Victoria also were offering a traineeship, and I applied for that, and for better or worse, I think for the better, I've certainly been very happy with the decision I made. They chose to employ me at a time where they took on three trainees at the time. And one of the unique things about us was in 1984, most of the dog guide mobility instructors working for GDV or working for Guide Dogs Australia, if you like, were based in Victoria. And we were taken on with the express purpose that when we qualified, we would be required to take up positions interstate. Assignment upon graduation was to become the dog guide mobility instructor in Tasmania. Lindy Ellis, who some of you might know, was required to travel to South Australia. She subsequently worked for Guide Dogs South Australia and now manages the RSB program in South Australia. And Graham Mitchell, who for many years managed the New South Wales program, his first assignment was to travel west to Perth. So uh, 37 years later, I'm still in the industry. I don't think I'll make 50 years, but who knows? There have been a number of staff now who've served 50 years in roles like mine. And it is the type of role that people come to and they seem to stick at. So I'm very much hoping that those young people that I mentioned earlier do stick around and make a difference over a long period of time. Some of you might be quite surprised with the decision that I made just two short years ago to leave the Guide Dogs Australia fold, where I was working at Guide Dogs New South Wales at the time, and join Vision Australia Seeing Eye Dogs. Now, I'm just going to point out that we are not CEDA. We were CEDA, but we are now Vision Australia Seeing Eye Dogs. Yeah, so there was quite a bit of surprise after so many years being intimately connected with the guide dogs brand, so to speak. Yeah, many people were surprised. So was I, to be quite honest. But I made the change, and I'm really enjoying it. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about that. We're largely politics free, but we're not entirely politics free. But I wanted to make some comments about it, and I think this is not a question about loyalty. My alma mater is Guide Dogs Victoria, and a piece of me will always be residing there, inescapably so. My recent time at Guide Dogs New South Wales was very successful, working with a team, a great team there who did a great deal to increase the amount of dogs that were available and also the quality. And because I'm no longer part of that team, I wouldn't wish them any less success as a result. I'm a person, you know, who likes change, and one of the ways I've been able to satisfy that need has been to travel widely in my role and make changes over time. I'm a GDMI first, and like most guide dog mobility instructors, our loyalties are firstly to our clients and our colleagues, and I think that's an important thing to consider. So in my new role, as I say, I'm really happy in my new role. And I can tell you right now, my plan is to make Vision Australia Seeing Eye Dogs bigger and better. And ironically, that's exactly the same goal that I've always had with every organisation I've worked with. It's really in all of our interests to have all of the providers be successful. Friendly competition is a fabulous thing. It leads to innovation. It improves our service mentality. In the future, our dogs are becoming more and more alike as we share breeding stock through international collaboration. So the challenges for providers are going to be to provide better service and be more responsive, I think, to the needs of consumers in the future. And I think that's just a great thing. And if I could just give one example of that I think is really important to recognise. And in my time with the Guide Dogs Australia group, I remember a number of instances where clients who couldn't obtain a dog from Vision Australia Seeing Eye Dogs obtained a dog from the Guide Dogs Australia group, and they were successful with those dogs. So what a fantastic outcome. But I can also remember, and I can also point you towards exactly the opposite, clients who were not successful with their application with a Guide Dogs Australia member and have been successful with a Vision Australia Seeing Eye Dog. So, there's really clear examples of where having more providers in the market is very much to the advantage of consumers. I've got to say that changing brands for me was actually hard. And as a consumer with relationships that you might build up over many years, for you too, deciding to move to a guide dog's dog after having a seeing eye dogs, seeing eye dog might be hard, as might be choosing to apply for a seeing eye dogs after having guide dogs for many years. I think we are all subject to those human feelings that come with the loyalties that we develop to people and to organisations. I think the important thing is that we treat each other very well and support each other with the comments that we make. So having joined Vision Australia, I was really tempted to look back into the whole question of CEDA and how I felt about that brand and so on and so forth, and go back to its genesis. And that had me looking a little bit at history, and I'll give you some statistics now, which I think were really, really interesting. And The first locally trained dogs were from Western Australia, as many of you would know. In 1952, there were two dogs trained. Both of them were placed with Western Australian clients. In 1953, there was one dog trained, and it also was placed with a West Australian client. In 1954, two dogs were trained, both again to Western Australian clients. 1955, three, two of which went to Western Australia, and one, the first outside Western Australia, came to New South Wales, to a country town that some of you may know called Inverell in northwest New South Wales. In 1956, a few more dogs in four, but again, they all went to Western Australian clients. 1957, I think, was the watershed year where production increased. There was 11 dogs trained, three for Western Australia, five went to New South Wales, the first dog into South Australia, and two went to Victoria. One of those was Lady Nell, the dog that Mrs. Gratian, the founder of Lady Nell Seeing Eye Dogs Australia, that was her dog. So that was 1957. And I'd also point out that not only was it, you know, taking a while to get dogs into other states, you know, by 1957, there wasn't a dog in Queensland. There wasn't a dog in Tasmania. There wasn't a dog in Northern Territory. But all of these guys were real pioneers, weren't they? You know, they were always the first dog into the cafe. They were always the first dog on the bus. So it also had me thinking about Mrs. Gratian herself, who, rightly or wrongly, you know, has been considered a bit of a villain over times. You know, I can't comment on whether she was a tyrant or a villain or otherwise. And I can't really comment about what her motivations were, but I wonder how we would view a person, a woman like this today, starting an organisation from scratch. Would we view her as tough and entrepreneurial, and perhaps we would celebrate some of those characteristics? Because regardless, you know, given today's mantra of choice for consumers, we might actually think different of her starting a new program. So, yeah, I think that's an interesting thing to consider when we look back at the history of which we are all part of, I might add. So we are likely with the NDIS to see new providers come onto the scene in the future. We have already seen new providers enter the scene in with Mary and Jason and Stapple. And that can only be a good thing for consumers, but there is definitely going to be some challenges. And I'd like to, I'm chewing up the time, aren't I? I'd like to just tell you a little bit about my experience in Germany. I had a school for a time there. I ran my own school in Germany in a NDIS-like world. Dogs in Germany have been paid for by the insurance companies for, well, as long as I know, probably 30 or more years. I had a school there and I delivered dogs in much the same way that Mary and Jason are operating with Stapple here in Australia. The scheme in Germany is not so generous in many respects as the one here. It doesn't pay for people to have the support workers and other supports that the NDIS generously provides, but it does pay for the dog and the training with the client and limited amounts of post-training support. So one of the risks, I think, in that system was that in Germany at any one time, and nobody can actually tell you how many providers there are, but there could be anything between 50 and 100 different providers, all providing various levels of quality service and a lot more breed choice than we would be able to provide. The challenge there has often been that people are attracted to the industry, and practitioners and providers are attracted to the industry because of their love of dogs and their expertise with dogs. But in many cases in Germany, my experience was that people didn't fully understand the need and challenges of the actual consumers. And that on occasions led to poor dog selection and ineffective client support. Small providers do have challenges, greater challenges in terms of matching dogs, because when I had a small school and a small number of clients, I didn't have the variety of dogs to match with people. I had less resources to breed and raise those dogs. So, that was much more challenging. And I needed to be even more mindful of costs. I found it hard to provide the geographic coverage. So, if I had a client who needed my support, 500 kilometres away in another part of Germany, I found that very difficult to provide as well. And also to provide dogs rapidly was also a bit of a challenge. In Germany, also, there are some issues in dealing with the funding provider, the equivalent of the NDIS, and I think that's something we're going to see more of here, and something that I think we're going to have to work together with to ensure that we get good outcomes for everybody. So getting the funding was one of the problems, and insurers began demanding more and more evidence that a person would benefit from having a dog guide. And one of the things that the German insurance started to do was asking non-GDMIs, non-professionals within the field, to determine eligibility of a client for a dog guide. One of the other challenges was that before schools were paid, there was a requirement that an independent evaluation of the team performance be made. And this was often made by, again, a person who might not have a lot of expertise in the dog guide function. And they may ask the client to do unrealistic things, such as undertake the test in an area and in an environment that's completely unknown to client or dog. The concept of independent evaluation is not bad in itself, but if we ever end up with something similar in this country, I think we need to be very mindful that it is consumer focused and actually evaluates the things that are important to the consumer with their dogs, not something that an independent person might think is important.
1 minute. Paul.
Okay, I will be fast. So there's definitely advantages in having multiple providers. The capacity to develop specialist niche product or breed preferences is a great thing. But here in Australia, we have a great advantage in having a hybrid system. We may well have more independent providers come on stream, but we've also got the big traditional providers in the background with their philanthropic support, which will ensure that we've got the capacity to invest in breeding, we've got the capacity to invest in training the staff of the future, and also the capacity to train clients who may require additional service because of complex needs, or those who may not be able to attract the funding through NDIS and others. So just before I hand over, and I'll consume 30 seconds of extra time, a couple of things that have changed since 1984. In 1984, there were about 250 active guides around the country. Today, my best guess is there's somewhere between 900 and 950 active dog guide users in the country. And that is certainly growing at the moment, because while we were producing around 50 dogs for the entire country back in 1984, today that number is probably around the 130 to 160 mark. Okey-doke. I will be quiet, but very happy to take some questions.
Thanks, Paul. That was fascinating. A great, run through the history of dog guides in Australia and also your overseas experience. We've got a couple of questions already. Claudia said you will not be surprised about this question from her, and that is there a future for blind people as dog guide mobility instructors?
Yeah, it's a great question, Claudia. Look, I would like to think so. There are challenges to that, but I certainly don't think they're challenges that can not be overcome. In Germany, my puppy raising supervisor was a woman who was totally blind. She would take her dog guide out and check out the puppies, and she did a fabulous job. So that's one role, and I think there are others. So
great.
I'd like to think so.
Good, thanks. And Nicole had a question up around the NDIS. So it's great for us consumers, etc. But has it created friction in the dog guide agencies?
No, I don't think it's created friction in the dog guide agencies, but it's certainly created some challenges for us. There's some good challenges in that too, because we are forced to be more proactive. We're forced to examine our business practices in greater detail. And I also think that over time, it will encourage us to develop an even greater focus on consumers than we've had in the past. And I don't think we've not been consumer-focused, but I think we will get better and better at that, and there'll be some nice bits of service innovation into the future, which I think will be to everybody's benefit.
Great. Thanks, Paul. Any other questions there, Erica?
Kevin, I've got one, if I may, for Paul.
Yes, Greg.
Yeah, just around younger people being trained with dog guides, whether you had any experience of that overseas, or I know there's some agencies now dipping their toe in the water over here, and your thoughts around that?
Yeah, it's a funny one, because if we go back in history in Australia, we were training in the early days many, many people, in the 15, 16, 17-year range. We are at Seeing Eye Dogs, we're certainly willing to explore people in younger age groups. We recently trained a young man very successfully. He'd only just turned 14, so I'd like to say he was 13, but he was actually 14 in a few days. So he'd been very successful. There are schools, and if you want to Google it, MIRA in Canada, MIRA. They are evangelical about their program of training young people in the sort of 12 to 15 year age group, and they are extremely successful with it, and they do a lot of it, not one or two here or there. They do a lot. I would like to think again that there will be a lot more younger people using dog guides in the future, because they bring many, many benefits, not just in terms of mobility, but there's some evidence around the social benefits that come with using dog guides as well. So the evidence is in, it's doable. We just need to get cracking on that one.
Great, great. Thanks, Paul.
Nadia had a question.
Thanks, Erica. Yep.
Hi, Paul. My question is, what do you think has been the biggest progress, or the biggest progress in your time in the industry?
I'm going to mention two things, Nadia. I think, first of all, the advent of PRT, positive reinforcement training, means that dogs today are better trained than they have been ever. The dogs really know what to do, and that's really important, because I have to say, expectations of applicants are much higher than they were. You know, in 1984, people would go home with a dog and it could be pretty ropey for 3 or 6 months, and that was the standard issue. Most people don't have the time or the energy or the capacity to manage that today, because they want to be back commuting to the office comfortably after a week. So I think that's one thing. And the second thing is the public access issue. And I actually think we have taken backward steps over the last 20 or 30 years. And that's particularly in relation to the management of dogs on the street, where, you know, we've got more dogs in cafes and more cafes with dogs than ever before. And while we're eating our smashed avo on toast, a lot of those dogs are leaping out from the table to take a chunk out of our dogs as we walk past. I think this is a much greater problem today than it was in the 1980s, to be perfectly honest. That's not a positive change at all.
Yeah, challenge. Thanks. We will really need to wind up. Was there any last questions?
I've got something, Kev. It's not a question. It's Mary mentioned and Paul mentioned about German Shepherds and Fidalco. A members' meeting a couple of years ago was held by Dog Guide Handlers Australia, and we've got a two-part session from those people on the website if people are interested and wanted to go and have a listen. It's under audio and under members' meetings. There's a two-part audio of people from Fidalco and our members asking them questions.
Great. Thanks, Greg. All right, we will wind that up there. Look, I just want to really thank Paul Adrian for taking the time. I hope your auction goes spectacularly well, or has gone already for you. But we really appreciate you. You've been to every conference, DGHA conference that I've been at. So very, very happy to have you back.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website, www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?